The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And there's a distinction between the two because it's very easy to get entangled in the various philosophical views about what is self, what is not self, is there a self, is there a true self. And pretty quickly, if you go that philosophical route, you'll end up, if you're philosophically inclined, meaning that if you really want to get into the underlying assumptions behind statements about self, this is a self, this is not a self, in some philosophical way, if you go into that route, pretty soon you'll get entangled. It's a quagmire, the Buddha said. So in Buddhism, there's a tendency not to get too much into the philosophy because of the philosophical problems and metaphysics of self, but rather to look very directly in how we construct a self, that part of ourselves that is constructed, is created, and the process of creating a sense of self and representation we have for ourselves, and to look at it very deeply, and in the process of looking at it, not to come to some philosophical conclusion, but rather to free ourselves from the way in which that construction happens, the way in which that formation of self happens that causes us to suffer. And a lot of human suffering occurs around this concept of self. And as soon as you have a concept, an idea, then we focus on how that idea comes into being, the creation around it, not whether it's true or false, or all the associated beliefs, assumptions, operating principles that come gather around our self-concept as it's formed. As soon as we say self, you know, myself, who are you? Who am I? And we operate, you know, I'm a certain kind of person, I'm a self. It tends to be a magnet for a lot of different beliefs around what it means to be a self. So we have cultural beliefs from our particular culture, whatever that culture you might come out of. And if you're bicultural and living in different cultures, then you have to negotiate sometimes different cultures' concepts of what it means to be a self. Sometimes it can be a little bit crazy-making to go back and forth, and sometimes it's very liberating to go back and forth different cultures to see, oh, it's this way in one culture, it's this way in another culture. I feel very lucky that I spent a lot of my time growing up and as an adult as well, living in different cultures, radically different cultures from each other. And it was very interesting to see how different ways in which people see reality, see themselves, see society, see self in these different cultures. And if you can do that, be multicultural, then it throws a different light on your culture, on your sense of self, because then you realize, wait a minute, what I thought was universal is really not. It's really something that's constructed here and now. And many of the ways in which we think of ourselves as self in modern culture, there's many ways of doing it, but some of the standard kind of concepts of self, what it means to be a person, are not that old. I mean, there's a history to these ideas. And some of these ideas don't go back very far. They go back maybe 20 years, sometimes 50 years, maybe a couple of hundred years. But if you go back to the time of the Romans, and you transported a Roman to here, he or she wouldn't recognize the concept of self that we have. It's like, wow, this is very different. If you go back to the time of the Buddha, in many ways we wouldn't recognize, the Buddha wouldn't recognize many of our concepts of self as either. That's kind of odd. But if you don't have some sense of the history of ideas or the history of, or this multicultural kind of perspective, it's all too easy to take your cultural view as being the view. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with that, but it's very common for people to suffer because of these views. And some people suffer themselves, and some people impose suffering on others because of these views. And there's a lot of human suffering among, people feeling they don't fit in because I don't have the right kind of self in this particular group, or I'm supposed to be different than who I am. And some of this can also be internalized, where the different parts of an individual is our war with ourselves. We feel, I feel like I'm this kind of person, but I can't be that kind of person, so I'll try to be someone I'm not. And then the person, then it gets more and more complicated in there. But if we begin to appreciate that all concepts of self are created, are formed, have history, kind of social history to them, then we can begin questioning whether we have to operate by them all the time. Maybe they're not inherent. Maybe they're useful in some situations, not in others. And then we can kind of begin loosening up, lightening up on them, and not use them as sources of suffering, of conditions for suffering. So let me just give you one little example of the history of ideas around self. A word that's entered into our English language, which is people use really freely, and it's as if we know what we're talking about. And it, people organize themselves and talk, use this word a lot to refer to things, is the word ego. He has a big ego, we say. Or, you need to develop a strong ego in order to get around in life. Or there's all these ideas of what the ego is. And as far as I can tell, that word as a kind of concept of self came to the English language as a translation of, it's a Latin word. For some reason, the translator chose to use a Latin translation, Latin word, to translate a German word by Freud. And he was using an ordinary German word, and myself, I think, was the self or the I. And so I don't know why they chose the Latin word, but that gave it a certain prominence and value and weight. I mean, Latin is like the language of authority. Some English speakers want to avoid all Latinized words in English and get down to basics. I'm ordinary. I speak kind of like basic English without any Latin. But we have this word ego, right? And it doesn't go back that far. When did Freud coin, he probably wrote that in the early 1900s. And now it's like we can't live without it. It's such an important word, but, 200 years ago they lived without it. Apparently for Freud, it was a process. And, to be simple about what he had idea. But when you say the ego, it can seem like it's not a process, but it's a thing that we have. So that's one example, the history of ideas of how something enters our language and morphs and changes. Another idea, which I learned recently, I thought was kind of interesting, not directly connected to our modern idea of self, but I found out that the word generosity comes from Latin as well. And Latin, it means a noble person. And like a person, like the way that generation means like people, or gentry comes from the word like a noble person. Generosity comes from the word, means to be a noble person. And it doesn't have to do with, being, what we think of being generous, offering things, giving things, being giving. And until about the 17th century, when the expression started to be applied to people who weren't noble by birth, but had noble character. So then it became kind of an intent of noble character. And then one aspect of noble character is to be giving. And so then the word changed until now. It's important to be generous, they say. And what it means is to be giving, as opposed to being noble, which was the original meaning. So none of this is wrong, that it changed, bad or good that it's changed. Just things change, right? History of ideas. And so the idea of what we think of what it is to be a human being also shifts and changes over time. And so we live in our own conditioned realm of self. So this is maybe only partially interesting for you tonight. So what happens when we sit to meditate is sooner or later we'll confront the suffering that comes with our concept of self. will encounter the limitation that comes with a concept of self that we're living under. In certain situations, our concept of self works just fine. But as the mind gets quieter and stiller, it doesn't make sense to keep operating that sense of self. It's not the right place and time for that to be operating. So for example, if my sense of self is that I need to be very, someone who's really efficient. I need to get a lot done. I'm that kind of person. Energetic. I go this, I can just get a lot done and I'm proud of it. And then I sit down to meditate. And I carry with me actively, but maybe subtle in the background of my mind, but it's an active little kind of thing going on that I'm an efficient kind of guy. And meditation is not efficient. and so as you meditate and they're being quieter, at some point you get quiet enough that the spinning of your inner wheels, that thought, as subtle as it might be, stands out. And we realize, and you somehow have to come to deal with that thought, that idea that is operating. And you have to either put it aside, drop it, drop that orientation, drop that point of view, operating from that point of view, or you're going to suffer. So you have to be able to put it aside. It's not like wrong. If you are efficient, it's not wrong to think of yourself as efficient. But if you hold on to that as this is who I have to be, then sooner or later in meditation, you'll confront that activity in the mind operating, and you have to start wondering, what should I do now? Do I hold on to it? Do I go out and get instructions on efficient meditation? There was this great joke that was circulating around Spirit Rock about this person who was very proud of himself for, learning to meditate at Spirit Rock. And someone asked him, how was the 45-minute meditation? Oh, it was great. I nailed it in 10. So that would be great, right? You come to IMC, get it over with by 7:40, and go, do other things. You want to be efficient. So the idea of sooner or later we start confronting all these ideas. And if they're operating, then we have to either be able to drop them, let go of them temporarily if they're not useful, or continue spinning them out. Now, some of the concepts of self are fine. They may be healthy to have them. They're in certain situations. But when we're asking the mind to become peaceful and still, then we start noticing that whether we're attached to even the good concepts of self, even the good ways we're operating, because if we're attached, then we can't let go of them. Some things become clear right away. They're kind of gross activities in the mind. And some are very, very subtle. And part of the great benefit and opportunity of meditation is that as the mind gets quieter, we start seeing the things that are operating really subtly. That you just can't see if you're kind of living a busy, ordinary life. And subtle doesn't mean that it's insignificant. Sometimes the more subtle operation is the very cornerstone that supports the whole edifice of how we think, who we think we are, and how we operate. And so sometimes it's really useful to get down there, really quiet, to see the subtlest little movements of thinking and thought that we think are true, that we're holding on to. So there's many, many things that can represent that cornerstone of our life, and each of you has your own. Some of them are inherited or learned from our experiences in life, from our family. For example, there are people who, ancestors have gone through tremendous suffering. And they carry with them that sense of pain. They carry with them that sense of life is dangerous wherever they go. And there's a kind of movement, things are dangerous. And it might not operate normal life, but as it gets quieter, a sense of fear is there in the background. There's something, it's not safe this way. Or there are people who got the message that from some place that maybe they're inadequate, they don't measure up, or they're not worthy, or they got the message that somehow in order to be successful you have to have a lot of things. You have to have an education, or you have to have a spouse, or you have to have a house, or you have to have this or that. And it might be very subtle ideas, but they kind of, those subtle ideas spawn bigger ideas and bigger ideas and actions in the world. And so as we get quiet enough, we get to start sooner or later see what some of these thoughts are. And the amazing thing that can occur in meditation, and it can be happen in other places as well, is you can come to a place where you put these subtle ideas aside and you realize you haven't disappeared, you haven't died. You realize that you're fine at that moment, in that context, in this situation. And it allows the heart to rest in a way that it can't rest if it's spinning these thoughts and living on ideas and concepts and all this stuff. And it's an amazing thing to have the heart rest deeply and to be at peace with itself, when it doesn't have to be anything for anybody. It doesn't have to prove itself, but also it doesn't have to apologize for itself. Some people are so apologetic, they feel like just being alive, they should apologize. And for me, my thing was, when I was young, when I was starting practice, that's what practice highlighted for me. For me, it was like, my little subtle thing, right, was the foundation of everything, was who I am, my essential self, my true self, was I was guilty. And so, that was a good one to carry around, because, it caused a lot of suffering. And so I had to learn to put that aside. And then there was a period of time where I carried with me this concept, I've been wronged. So that was one that burned me up a lot. A lot of, I've been wronged. Sometimes I had been wronged, but it was like, carrying that idea inside of me was like having a knife in my heart. And so I had to learn to put that aside. And then I had this subtle idea that it was really important to be liked. In fact, it was important that everybody liked me. And somehow that was built into the nature of the universe, that it was important to make everyone like me, because if something terrible would happen if I didn't. So I was involved in all this social gymnastics. And that exhausted itself. That came to an end when I realized how painful it was. It was just like I was getting, I was just exhausting myself trying to do it. So I had to give up, because it's an impossible thing to do. No one. I don't think anybody can please everybody. We can please some people sometimes, but everybody, no good. I love that little poem by the Buddha. He says, they'll criticize you if you speak too much. They'll criticize you if you speak too little. And they'll criticize you if you speak just the right amount. No one in this world is free of criticism. So I think about that a lot when I'm giving these talks, looking at the clock and wondering, how long should I talk for? So part of the function of meditation is to begin looking more deeply at these things. Now, one of the things to notice, that meditation is a place to see it, but it can be seen in other places in life as well, is the relationship between self, our concept of self, our selfing that we do, our ideas of self, and our emotional life. And it goes in two directions. The concepts of self that we operate under can be one of the triggers for a whole array of different emotions we have, the conditions for certain emotions to arise. The other way it works is that certain emotions we have is the conditions for the arising of certain concepts of self. So sometimes emotions produce self ideas, and sometimes emotions come out of self. So for example, how emotions come out of a concept of self. So if my concept of self is that I am efficient kind of guy, and I'm really efficient today, then I feel really fulfilled. I feel like I've proved my true self. I feel elated. I feel light. I feel good. Isn't this great? If I'm really inefficient today, then I feel deflated. I mean, it's kind of frustrating to be inefficient, perhaps, if you want to be efficient. But if my sense of self is connected to it, then my sense of self has been threatened, and I feel discouraged. Or if my sense of self is related to feeling like someone who needs to please everybody, then if I stop pleasing someone, if someone is angry with me, then I feel depressed because my sense of self, I haven't lived up to the sense of self that I feel like I need to be. If my sense of self is tied to to possessions, to having certain possessions, and those possessions disappear, I can't afford them or something, then I could feel embarrassed. Some people's sense of self is connected to the clothes they wear. And so you have to wear certain clothes. If you don't have those clothes, then you feel like you're not quite, then you kind of feel deflated or you feel embarrassed. There's all kinds of concepts of self that encourage us to feel, a trigger for us to feel more embarrassed, to feel afraid that sense of self gets threatened. A sense of self gets, we don't live up to it in the eyes of others or something, we feel embarrassed because of it. Angry, our sense of self is threatened, some people get angry. You know, someone says to you, what do they say, you're a lousy driver. That might be good information to know. But they've said it in a way, they didn't say, oh, by the way, would you like to have some feedback on your driving, you're a nice person, but I'd like to give you some feedback. Because they go, okay. They just say, you're a lousy driver. And so suddenly, it's interesting information, but we take it into that place in our brain, our mind, where we have an idea of who we have to be in the eyes of others, and that's been threatened. So we get angry, we get embarrassed, we get afraid. There's a whole series of things we might do in result. Sometimes that self, when it gets, reinforced, we feel joy. Certain kinds of joy come because that sense of joy, that sense of self has been, fed. So someone comes and praises you. And maybe, who knows if the praise is real or not, but they praise you. And so you feel, wow, that's really good. I feel kind of good now. There's an interesting social phenomena where some people get energized when they get praised, and they get energized when they get criticized. And when socially, in the conversation with other people, if neither praise nor criticism happening, then they get bored. So if you're the kind of person who somehow, is challenging to their sense of self or praiseful sense of self, they're interested in you. But if you do nothing for their sense of self, they get kind of like lose interest in you. So the sense of self is operating there. So you might consider, you might wonder, you might look at the variety of different emotions you have in the course of the day and look at them and see, is there at the heart of it, at the source of it, some concept of self, some concept of who you think you need to be that's operating? Some concept that you think, or some concept that you think other people have about who you need to be? Or what's the concept, what's the ideas of self that are being challenged, threatened, delighted in the situation? But then, if you look at the sense of self that you have, the ideas of self you have, very few of us are philosophers. Very few of us are operating. And so to look again to the philosophical idea of Buddhism, what Buddhism has to say philosophically about the self, is not that interesting to the heart, really. I can give you a dissertation on, the Buddhist concept of self and not self and all that. And it won't really speak to your heart, to what's really going on there. Because the concepts that you have around self are there because you're trying to cope with your life the best you can. I believe that it's hard for most people to get around in life, to live this life. And we're trying the best we can to find how to be safe, how to be have security, how to find happiness, how to, you know, basic things like that. And there's deep emotional or kind of drives for safety, for security, for happiness, for love, for, you know. And as we look for that, as the heart looks for that, it's trying to find out how can I organize my life, how can I set things up so that I can be safe, so there can be happiness here, so that I can be free of threat. And so part of this conceiving of a self is part of that enterprise to make ourselves safe and happy, and to find love and support in our life. And so, if you step back behind the sense of self and start feeling the underlying drives that go into the creation of self, the interest, why we're interested in having a self to begin with, then we can start looking deeper into kind of the underlying, this underlying kind of operating system that is much more interesting to look at than do we have a self or don't we have a self. And then we can start asking or looking at our life at a deeper, more fundamental level. What is it that really provides safety? What is it that really brings happiness? What's the source of love itself? We can answer those questions the best if we can sit very quiet and still underneath the concept of self that we live by and really feel deeply what is moving inside of us. What's trying to be asked? What's trying to be accomplished in here and now? And the stiller we can sit, the deeper we can go into the heart to feel those impulses. And then we have a chance to answer them in new ways. And there's many ways of answering these questions. One of the things that meditation practice can show you is how little needs to happen for you to be safe, for you to be happy, for you to find love. That actually, not in conventional ways. I mean, if you sit and meditate in the middle of Highway 101, you're not going to be very safe. So you can't just say, well, meditation makes me safe anywhere I go. But to experience in meditation, in the safety of your home perhaps, or in your here at IMC, hopefully, to experience a profound letting go where we have, I'll say it a different way, part of the process of meditation in our tradition is to slowly deconstruct all the layers and layers and layers of selfing that we live under. Slowly deconstruct all the different ideas that we live with. Not because they're necessarily bad, not because we don't need them in their own time and place, but to be able to drop and go lower and lower so we discover a radical freedom, a radical peace, a radical openness, a radical emptiness that is there in the heart when we don't operate under any constructs at all. When we don't compare ourselves to others, we don't compare ourselves to ourselves, we don't hold ourselves by certain standards, ideas, good and bad. So many things we're told that we need to have and be in order to be successful or a good person are all constructs. And it's an amazing revolutionary thing to drop down into the heart and set the heart radically at peace, free of all the constructs, and know that that's a possibility. It's kind of like a Copernican revolution to do that. It's kind of like how Copernicus showed us that the earth is not the center of the universe. Until him, that's what we thought, humans, apparently. And it was a big revolution to realize the earth wasn't at the center. Imagine to realize, if you realize that what you thought was at the center of your universe, your world, was not really the center. And so the concepts that we carry with us, we often live with them as if they're the center of this. Everything's oriented around them. And this process of deconstruction, of letting it all fall away, letting go, relaxing, finding this deep peace, realize that those ideas are not the center. They might have usefulness, but we don't have to keep them at the center. We can keep something else at the center. And meditation practice, Buddhism, points to a different center, one that's open, transparent, free, one that is peaceful, one that's radiant, one that's, you know. And then from that perspective, then we can begin choosing which concepts of self we want to pick up again. Rather than just having it be unexamined and kind of, rather than just being kind of enslaved or being caught in certain kinds of concepts of self, we can then begin to choose which ones are useful. And it's important to have concepts of self. Sometimes I operate under the concept I'm a man. And much of the day I don't think about it too much. And I'm glad I can put it aside. But sometimes that operates. And our society expects me generally to operate in that concept because some places they have men in women's bathrooms. And it would be a problem if I went into the wrong one. I did it once. I didn't realize until I was sitting in the stall that I was in the wrong place. I don't know how this happened, but some of us need mindfulness more than others. So then, what do I do now? So I had this problem then, sitting in the stall, wondering what I'm supposed to do, because I hadn't operated under the right concept. So that was embarrassing. It's embarrassing telling you. So I still have these concepts I live under. Anyway, so certain concepts are important to have and useful to have in certain contexts and places. So meditation practice gives you, not meditation by itself, but some of the realizations, some of the freedom that come from meditation, gives you a much wider range of choice. And choice is almost the same thing as freedom. And if you are stuck in your concept of self, if you're stuck being a man, stuck being a woman, stuck being a transgendered person, whatever you think you are, then there's not much freedom. But if you know how to drop it in certain situations, those ideas, those concepts, and pick them up when they're appropriate, then you can be much more free in this world. So I think I've run out of things to say. This is what I had in mind today to talk about. We have 5 minutes, so maybe not so much, but I'm curious to hear from some of you what you think of what I said or what comments or questions you might have. Please. I see the mic is...
It's so interesting that you're talking about this. I've been considering this a lot, and mostly around the idea of status. For an egalitarian society like America, supposedly, there seems to be a lot of status involved and a lot of suffering around attaching yourself to a particular status. And especially since Buddhism comes from a caste society where perhaps the Buddha talked about caste and status, how does Buddhism inform us in regards to attaching ourselves to status and perhaps freeing ourselves from specifically high or trying to be high status or low status in society?
Great question. I think it might be a complicated question because there's so many ways of comparing and contrasting people. And I think the automatic assumption is that comparing and contrasting is bad. You know, we're supposed to all be equal, not supposed to be any. But there are differences, different situations. And when is it appropriate to make those comparisons? When are they meaningful and help us find our way better? And when are they a hindrance? I think the problem comes when we take status or take the differences we can identify or differences we imagine and all that, and start judging people inherent worth. And I'm better and worse, those kinds of ideas. And it can be very painful to do that. Buddhism distinguishes between three kinds of conceit. There's a conceit that we're better than others, better status. There's a conceit that we're worse than others, we're inferior. And then the third kind of conceit that Buddhism teaches is the conceit that we're equal to others. And that's also a conceit because, and there's a lot of, there can be a lot of selfing operating and insisting we have to be equal. You and I have to be equal, and you know you're getting more, you're getting less, you know, and it's still this idea of self operating. The alternative is simply not play the game of selfing, not care whether you're better, or worse, or equal to others. Just be. That's one thing Buddhism says about it. Another thing Buddhism says is to turn the attention around and question how it operates in us. And what's the suffering and attachment involved in us? And then turn around and look at ourselves. But then also at some point turn it outwards and really be attentive to notice what are the consequences of the views that you have. If you have the concept, I'm the hottest, you know, best, you know, person around, how does it make other people feel? You know, I hadn't noticed it makes everyone else feel lousy. I feel good, but everyone else is lousy. You know, is this how I want to live my life? Feeling I'm good and everyone else, you know, making everyone else feel lousy around me? So Buddhism emphasizes this thing of mindfulness. Look at the consequences in yourself, because chances are if you notice that you're kind of conceited, not necessarily you are, but someone is conceited, then sooner or later, if you're really mindful, you'll feel the suffering, the contraction inside that's involved. If you bring your mindfulness externally, you'll see the effect it has on the people around you. So Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on mindfulness, and if you bring mindfulness to it, you'll start discovering, you know, an alternative because it's not good. At the same time, there are differences between people. You talked about the caste system. The Buddha offered an alternative to the caste system, which was the monastic order. And he accepted no matter what your caste you were in, you were invited to. Buddha didn't distinguish between castes in terms of accepting him into the order. He did distinguish between the different castes in the sense that he would talk differently to the different castes because they had different ways of talking, you know. And so he would meet them kind of where they are at. So, you know, he acknowledged there were distinctions, but when he brought people into his community, those distinctions fell away. And everyone was invited to be equal. And so someone who was lowest caste was as welcome into the community as people who were higher caste. But within the community, his community, there was kind of a status difference or hierarchy based on two things. And one was the seniority, how long you were there as the monastic order. So someone low caste who'd been a monk or nun longer than a high caste person had more seniority than the high caste person. The other difference was there was a differentiation between spiritual attainment, spiritual maturity. And so the Buddha, and that's true for monastics and for lay people. And the Buddha said someone was of a high class, was noble, not by their birth. So nothing by who they were inherently, but rather by the qualities that they lived by. So someone lived with generosity, someone lived with wisdom, someone lived with purity of virtue. That person was seen as being a noble person. A person who lived unethically, was miserly, was seen as being, as being kind of a silly person or a stupid person. Not as inherently bad person, but as a fool. So there was a tendency in early Buddhism to make these distinctions. There are fools and there are noble people. Now, is that okay? Are we supposed to all be equal? You know, is it bad to do that, to make that distinction? What I think, you know, I don't know. I don't want to give exactly the final answer, but I think that the distinction that early Buddhism tries to make are distinctions that are helpful, for supportive, for helping us find a path towards freedom. So Buddhism doesn't say that people are sinful. The Buddha over and over again didn't talk about sinful people, but he did talk a lot about foolish people. Because if you're foolish, you can do something, you can get wise. And so, you know, to recognize someone as being foolish, you know, then... So are there distinctions to be made that are useful to be made, that support people improving themselves? Is the question I have here today. So that was offered as a challenge, not as an answer to our egalitarian society. So I hope that meditation gives you a place where you know that you don't have to be equal, you don't have to be better, you don't have to be worse. You can just be at peace. May you all be at peace. Thank you.